He was in the mood for a little confrontation. He just let it all hang loose. He didn't think about the news. He couldn't take no more abuse, so he shut down the congregation.
Expansive is one word that comes to mind when thinking of the work of legendary composer, arranger, and producer Quincy Jones. He's been a force in the music world for six decades, working with just about everyone. Count Basie, Sarah Vaughan, Frank Sinatra, Miles Davis, Tony Bennett, Michael Jackson, and Snoop Dogg, and that's just a short list. In 1961, Quincy was named vice president at Mercury Records, becoming the first high-level black executive of a major record company, and he's composed music for movies and television, including the theme songs for Ironside, The Bill Cosby Show, and Sanford and Son. Now, Quincy Jones has released a new CD, Q, Soul Bossa Nostra, and a book called Q on Producing, written with Bill Gibson and published by Hal Leonard Books. I'm thrilled that all of that brings him to our studio today. Welcome.
Thank you.
You've been working on other people's recordings for a long time. What brought you back to doing your own album now?
Well, this is, ironically, this is not, I wouldn't call this my own album. About 6 years ago, Timberland in South Beach had a dinner and said that the hip-hop community would like to do a tribute to my old songs. It's like Soul Bossa Nova is almost 50 years old. Mm-hmm. I wrote it, we got back with Dizzy Gillespie from Brazil. When the Bossa Nova first came out, the Big Band Bossa Nova, I wrote it in 20 minutes. And it's literally 48 years old. It's amazing.
And Dizzy also brought back a pianist from Brazil at that time.
Who?
Dizzy did. He brought back his pianist, I think, around that time from Brazil. Because
Lalo?
Yes, Lalo
Schifrin.
No, no,
no. No? Lalo, we met Lalo at a club. And Lalo told me about Nadia Boulanger, who I finally studied with, and Olivier Messiaen in Paris. But Lalo was playing in a club, and Dizzy told him if he ever got out of Buenos Aires, because he recorded with Astor Piazzolla back then, he said he would hire him with his band. So years later, Lalo left with Xavier Cugat, and he got to New York, and he left Xavier Cugat, and Dizzy hired him. But he was on the album, Bossa Nova. I mean, the Bossa Nova album.
So, you thought about bringing back that song and some of the other songs that you've done over the years?
Pardon?
So you then started thinking about songs you had worked on.
I didn't pick the songs. These guys, it's the first time I've ever experienced this, hands off. Mm-hmm. But they came to me every now and then for advice, and how should I do this? They picked the songs. The artists volunteered themselves, you know. So I can't really call it my album. I'm never going to do a tribute to myself. You know, that's not my style, you know.
Well, you have John Legend, Mary J. Blige, Usher, Snoop Dogg, Wyclef Jean, and Amy Winehouse singing Leslie Gore's classic, It's My Party.
That's right.
And I can't think of a better song for her to sing.
I agree.
A perfect match. So these people understood the things that you had done in the past that worked best for them?
Yes. I met her at a concert we did for Nelson Mandela's 90th birthday in London 2 years ago, and I had him introduce Leona Lewis, and I came back, and a man said, would you like to meet my daughter? I'd like you to talk to my daughter. And it was Amy, and she's a sweetheart.
A troubled sweetheart.
Little off the path, you know, but I got a few little play daughters like that.
You say a number of these artists pick songs they remember hearing their parents play.
That's right, way before that. Some of their mothers weren't born then, you know, like... Soul Bossa Nova, a lot of those songs are way back.
Now, you did change something. In the same week that George Bush said that his handling of Hurricane Katrina's aftermath was a mistake, you're releasing an updated version of your classic song, Hickey Burr, with new lyrics about Katrina. How did that come about?
That was the choice of the artist.
He wanted to throw in
the because that was some of the soundtrack from the Cosby, the theme from the Cosby Show. But they all made the choices of where they go, and my own advice was, put your voice on the song, but try to make it better than the one we did, you know.
And then you know wrote new arrangements?
No. Some of them used my arrangements, the original arrangements, like on Secret Garden and some of those things. They used the original arrangements and then added their thing to it. You know, the hip-hop thing, Double Time or 808s or whatever, you know. They put the thing on it. But it was a very unusual experience and a very honorable. I was very honored that they did this, you know, they took the energy to do this because, like, sweet Jennifer Hudson, right after that tragedy happened to her family in Chicago, I called her for condolences, to give her condolences, because I'm from Chicago, and I had a switchblade through my hand at 7 years old nailed to a fence, so I know Chicago. Hmm. And she said, I want to be on the album. I said, I would never bother you, Jennifer, at a time like this. She said, Quincy, you don't understand. I need to be on your album. And she's saying, you put a move on my heart, and her heart was in it.
Your book, we should mention the book as well, reads like a handbook for aspiring musicians and producers. And isn't this the first in a series?
Yes. We're going to do some more. More and more people coming after me saying you should put it down on the paper. I feel like I'm just starting in a way. The Nobel doctors, I have 14 Nobel doctors in Stockholm every year for 6 days at the Karolinska Hospital. And they are all musicians, and, man, they don't play. They're the smartest guys I've ever met in my life. And they are telling me how I have to lose weight. And if you do that between nanotechnology and the color-coded genome breakthrough, I can live to 110. And don't make up your mind till 109.
Well, you have seen the music industry change totally, the technology of it over the years.
When
you
60 began, years.
Yeah, and when you began, I'm not sure we were even using magnetic tape.
Are you kidding? It's 78 records.
So
78 records.
Yeah, you recorded right onto a disc, and then that became the master disc.
And cannot be over 3 minutes. And you have to record 4 every 3 hours.
And now people can record very sophisticated recordings in their own homes.
Anything you want. But I tell my kids and I tell a lot of the young rappers who come to me to say, teach me how to be a good real musician, is if you don't know music and don't know your science, you work for the machine, Pro Tools. And if you know the music, the machine works for you. And that's, we were the guinea pigs for all the synthesizers, you know. Mm-hmm. And thank God we were all musicians, you know.
So that's the first piece of advice you would give to somebody who's trying to start out?
Yes. Develop your science and your craft. Know your core skill. Because it's about science and soul. The emotion. Music is the only thing that engages left and right brain simultaneously.
Well, Q1 Producing is filled with technical advice, but you also have a lot of anecdotes from your life in music. What was your inspiration for the rib recipe, which you include in the book?
I didn't include it. The writer did.
The writer did. But it was, I'm going to try it out.
They're really good. Oprah does it on the show all the time. It's her favorite ribs. I cooked them for her down in Fisher Island in Miami. And she learned how to cook them now because the people didn't think she could cook before. So she does it now. I'm very happy because they're good, man.
You have worked with many great artists. Is there someone who stands out?
Pardon?
You've worked with so many great artists. Is it possible for you to say, well, two or three really stood out?
Billie Holiday and Ella and Sarah, Louis Armstrong, Basie Duke, Ray Charles, Aretha, Michael Jackson, Frank Sinatra. I don't think so.
You play a lot of instruments, didn't you?
Yes,
you
I
did anyway
all,
before
all
you settled on the trumpet?
All the brass instruments.
Do you think that helped you as an arranger?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why I love to write for brass, because I understand it. French horn, tuba, sousaphone, trombone, everything. I played it all.
Well, you began your career playing trumpet with Lionel Hampton's band, and that must have been a real thrill at the time. But why did you give up playing and concentrate on arranging fairly early in your career?
Because when I first picked my horn up, I started to hear other horns in my head. I've heard whole orchestras in my head when I was 13 years old. I used to stay up late at night writing so much that my eyes used to bleed. It was there from the very first day. And I think God gives us all our own jobs. I can't drive, but orchestration, arranging, and composing. And I also can see the talent in other people before anybody else sees it. So I've discovered Oprah Winfrey and Will Smith and all these people, the brothers Johnson, James Ingram. And it's a nice feeling. And to see them go all the way, because Will went from a rapper with Jazzy Jeff in 1987, 89, to the biggest star in Hollywood in the world. He is.
Went on TV,
He did The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, but he ended up now as the biggest star in the world.
Now, you, as I said, you began playing trumpet, and then you started arranging and composing. Jazz is an improvisatory art, but it's also an art which has produced some incredible songs
exactly,
over the years.
But see, at the same time...
Do you think as an improviser when you're composing?
Well, it's the same thing, but you have to understand all that came from the big bands, and the big bands had to have arrangements. And my first attraction to music at 13 was four trumpets, four trombones, five saxes, bass, drums, guitar, and piano, all doing something different but the same thing. The same with the symphony orchestra with woodwinds, brass, strings, and percussion. And I studied with Nadia Boulanger in Paris, who taught Stravinsky and Leonard Bernstein. So I'm going all the way.
And what could you learn from Nadia Boulanger? A lot of jazz musicians, and I'm talking about to apply to what you did here. If you wanted to write classical music,
no,
sure.
That's not about classical music. It's about 12 notes that God, as the voice of God. And she said, until you get 13, learn what everybody did with 12. Mm-hmm. Everybody, Stravinsky, Alban Berg, Ravel, Duke Ellington. Why did he put Harry Carney above the second tenor? All of it. It's got nothing to do with jazz. It's about knowing your craft, you know.
Didn't you meet Ray Charles when you were very young?
14. He was 16, was like 100 years older than me.
And what was that all about? Was he already somebody who you thought, well, this guy's got special talent?
No, nobody.
Because when you hear some of those early records like Greenbacks, he could have been of a million singers.
Ray sounded like Charles Brown and Nat Cole, and he played alto sax like Charlie Parker. He came from Florida, and he had a guy take a string and take him as far away from Florida as he could be, and that was definitely Seattle, which was the hottest city in America during World War II. Because they were going to the Pacific Theater. And Ray had sight till he was six, you know. And so he chose to teach me arrangement and braille and all that, you know. We did our whole lives together. We used to say every day, not one drop of my self-worth depends on your acceptance of me. Because the racism was so bad back then. And we didn't have the Oprahs and the Michael Jordans and all that to be there. We didn't know. On radio was only Beulah and Rochester, and they were servants, you know. So we had to make it up.
As recently as the 70s, I was in the record business, and we were trying to put an Al Green record on this new television cable series. I guess it was, what was it, the 70s or 80s? I guess it was the 70s. And they, I'm talking about, not VH1, the other one, MTV. And they wouldn't run it because he was inappropriate to their audience. And then it wasn't until Michael Jackson broke through that they started.
In the beginning, there were no black artists on it. And Rick James tried to put Super Freak on there. And Bob Pittman, who was my partner when I had a joint venture with Time Warner, Steve Ross asked us down one day in Acapulco, what's your next single? We'd put the McCartney single out already. I said, Billie Jean and Beat It. And he said, that goes on next week. Because when you really look at it, Michael Jackson and MTV rode each other to success.
It changed MTV.
Especially with Thriller. That changed everything. They went all the way.
Well, we'll take a little break and we'll come back and talk about Thriller and Michael Jackson and other things with Quincy Jones, who has a new book out called Q on Producing, written with the help of Bill Gibson, and it's published by Hal Leonard Books. Also a new CD, a tribute album to him by some of the leading artists of our time called Q Soul Bossa Nostra. Bossa Nostra. Like the mob.
That's right. That's the whole joke, you know.
For a second, I thought I had misspelled.
No, you're right. Soul Bossa Nostra.
We'll be back with more right after this.
So they gon' dig in. Yeah. Hold up.
I don't remember Sanford and Son sounding like that. That was Sanford and Son featuring T.I., V.V., Prince Charles, and who else?
Red One. He produced it. It's great.
They had a lot of fun with it, obviously.
Oh, yeah. And it was funny because when Bud Yarkin came to ask me to write the theme for that, he said, "I want you to go see the pilot." I said, "Who's starring in the series?" Because I tried to get the rights to the Death to a Spartan in Europe. That's became All in the Family. Mm-hmm. Norman Lear got it. I didn't know anything about TV then. And this came from Steptoe and Son, Sanford and Son. And so I said, Red Fox. I said, "Are you kidding? You can't put Red Fox on nationwide TV." Because I worked with him at the Apollo 30 years before.
He did not have a clean act.
Not one line.
I remember a few of the jokes. I can't tell them on the radio now.
No. And so I used to write his music for him when I worked with Billy Eckstein in my band to get him on stage, you know. And so I said, "I don't need to see that." And I wrote the theme in 20 minutes. We recorded in 20 minutes.
And the show was a giant hit. And he was brilliant in it.
Yes, he was. It was very successful.
For most of your early career, you worked within the jazz world. When did you branch out into pop music? When did you branch out into pop music?
I started at pop music, man. We played in Seattle with Ray Charles. We even played Shadishes, Bob Mitzvahs, Debussy, Sousa, rhythm and blues, strip music, pop music, everything from the day I started. And that's what cracks me up when I see a lot of my jazz snob friends talking about Quincy selling out. I'm following a trend. That's ridiculous. We've played every kind of music there was from day one. They were 13 years old.
And were you bringing that knowledge to things like working with Michael Jackson?
Of course. But it's everything.
Because that record swings so hard.
It's everything, you know. We made a lot of records. So like Sinatra records weren't so bad.
No. And Sinatra loved having
Sinatra,
great...
You can work with anybody.
He loved having great jazz trumpet players playing behind him.
Sweets Edison.
Sweets talked about doing all those obligati with Sinatra and how they let him do whatever he wants.
Sinatra in the sands said he was with us on that. We had so much fun.
Did you develop a personal relationship with Michael Jackson, or were you just working as his producer
Thriller? That's impossible. A relationship between producer and an artist is the biggest love affair there is. It's love and trust. Tremendous trust. Because if you don't have that, nothing's going to happen. Because when you ask somebody like Ray Charles or Sinatra or Michael to jump without a net, and a producer has to do that, to say, "Try this." Mm-hmm. And they say, "What?" You know, and if you don't know what you're talking about, it's not going to work. But when I worked with Frank, I was ready for him. Really ready for him.
Because you were a musician, he couldn't push you around.
They test you. And see, said it's a little too dense up in the first 8 bars. In 5 minutes, I'd change it, you know. And so I was ready for him. I worked with him from 1964 till he died in 1998.
Well, he had already worked with Nelson Riddle and Billy May. So he was putting you up against two other giants.
The best guys in the business, you know. But I was ready for him.
When I've been at record sessions where the thing is put together and everybody says, this is going to be a hit. And, of course, it doesn't always become a hit. Was there a point in the process of making Off the Wall and Thriller that you knew you were involved in something that was very special?
Of course. Of course you do. We go through 800 songs for nothing. Are you kidding? To get nine?
Absolutely. It was 800 songs initially?
We went through 800 songs.
Wow.
Yeah.
Had Michael written most of those?
We did Off the Wall. Now, Michael wasn't even in town. Uh-huh. He was on the road with his brothers. But he didn't even know what we were doing in Thriller. You know, because, you know, we have Vincent Price, too. Edgar Allan Poe. Modern rap that Rod wrote in the car on the way to the studio. Oh, no, nobody knew what we were doing. And nobody really got it until we did the video with John Landis a year later, in June 1984. And they got it, you know, because nobody had ever done anything like that before. And that goes back to the old saying, you can't get an A if you're afraid to get an F.
Because you got to take chances.
Take some chances,
saying.
Man. Yeah, a lot of chances.
Were you surprised when you received news that Michael had died?
Oh, absolutely. I came down from Shanghai, and I'd taken Holly Berry over to the film festival there. And I was there. She was there 3 days. She didn't know how much they loved her over there. And I stayed 2 weeks, and I went to Luxembourg, and the Duke and Duchess met us at the airport with a band, a beautiful arrival. And on the car on the way to town, they said, by the way, Farrah Fawcett, Ed McMahon, and Michael just died. And I was like, surrealistic. It, like somebody shot my brains off, you know.
So well, Farrah had been sick Michael. For a very long time, but Michael, that was a big surprise.
Pardon?
Farrah Fawcett had been sick for a long time, but it was a total surprise for Michael Jackson.
And Ed McMahon, too, you know. But I knew them a long time, you know. All of them a long time. It's just the whole idea, and it's still surrealistic with Michael. I just can't get my arm around it.
My guest is Quincy Jones. There's a new CD out called Q, Soul Bossa Nostra. Also a new book called Q on Producing, written with Bill Gibson and published by Hal Leonard Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You've been lobbying President Obama to appoint a U.S. Minister of Culture. You'd like to see a cabinet
that's
post?
As Secretary of the Arts.
Mm-hmm. As a cabinet position.
We all have
position.
Secretaries of, you know, agriculture and all that. So Secretary of the Arts. But I'm not involved in that process anymore. I had a date in Washington. I canceled it because we're building our own consortium. We've got every university in America. We've got Alan Kay and Sean Fanning, Herbie Hancock, Santana, the best minds. Because America's never had an accurate music curriculum in the schools, never. Because they don't understand. Classical music is European classical music. Our classical music is jazz and always will be. Every major tentpole R&B artist from Stevie Wonder to Marvin Gaye all come from the influences jazz.
Gospel and jazz, actually.
Well, of course. All right, but I mean, but jazz is what takes them to the top, you know, because harmonically and everything else, it has the most sophisticated elements.
And why do you think Americans are so ill-informed about their own classical music?
Because we're isolationists, and we're viewed as isolationists all over the world. Because 12% of Americans have passports, only 6% use them. You got to go to know and know what everybody else is going on. If people saw China and Abu Dhabi and the places around the world, they couldn't believe it. There are no rice paddies there.
There's also a sense of a generational gap that each generation only is interested in the music of its time. And that, you know, if you come to jazz, when Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie are the dominant figures, you don't listen to Louis Armstrong. You know, it's something that you have to actually want to know. And the same thing happens today with rock fans. They know who's big today, but they have no idea who was big in the 60s.
That's not going to work because you know what? In Russia, they know Rimsky-Korsakov, Shostakovich, and Stravinsky, but they know all about our background too. Germany, France. We would not have jazz if it wasn't for France. During slavery and in Paris. And I've been traveling, living in France and all these places. I've been there. all over the world, they know what's going on. Japan, the big, greatest jazz critics, Brussels, they know. They know everything about our music. And we have great jazz critics, too. We got Nat Hentoff and all of the people we've got. And but the audience, public at large, does not get it because they're not fed it. Their parents don't know. They know their own genre. And the schools don't know. And it really just infuriates me. It really does. Because that culture is what gives you your validity. I had my right-hand man, Adam Fell, investigate all of the similar incidents like Columbine. 89. None of them black, really. Little blonde, blue-eyed kids, you know, that are calling themselves neo-Nazis. And on when they're doing the email, they're saying, "Whoa, what's up, bros?" and da-da-da, speaking hip-hop. They don't know who they are, you know, because you got to go to know. And they don't travel. They don't know anything about any other countries. Oprah told me once that she saw two high school kids on television. They were asked the oxymoronic question, "What is the capital of Chicago?" The kids said, "Dallas, Texas." You know, and we got to stop that because we don't know, and we got to stop being isolationists.
Maybe that's because they're confusing Barack Obama with George Bush.
Pardon?
They're confusing Barack Obama with George Bush. Barack being from Chicago and Bush actually being from Crawford, Texas, but close enough.
Oh no.
So, do you have a major project in the works right now?
Always. I'm doing 9 movies, so one's on Alexander Pushkin in Russia. That's one of my pet projects. And Gorbachev helped me since 1987, and now all the Russians have come together to give us the money to do this because he's right with Goethe and Dante and Shakespeare, you know. He was half Ethiopian, so the regular thinking process. And the first one I'm doing is an IMAX film in Brazil. For the favelas, I go every year for 51 years to visit them. And Katrina, I'm taking the musicians from Mississippi and Louisiana down with a float made by the School of the Samba, and they're going to play together with the Brazilians at Corcovado and the Sugarloaf and all this. And it's to make money for the favelas and Katrina.
Meanwhile,
and Billy Friedkin's directing it.
We have this new book called Q on Producing, written with Bill Gibson, with a DVD included. It's the first in what's being called the Quincy Jones Legacy series, and it's published by Hal Leonard Books. Also, a new CD called Q Bossa Nostra that's on Quest Records, and it has been my great honor to talk with Quincy Jones today.
It's my great pleasure. You're a very astute man.
Shoes on feet, trying to dodge police. The storm took away my house, got no food to eat.